Welcome to the Philosophy Exchange podcast. This is a new episode. Today, I'm here with Graham, a fellow PhD student of mine at the University of Edinburgh. And I wanted to take the chance to chat to Graham about school of philosophy that I have had not much interaction with. And I think a lot of people know about it, but don't know much about it. And I thought, you know, why not ask Graham more about the school of Buddhist philosophy, where you come from? Welcome to the podcast, Graham.
Thanks, Johanna. Thanks for having me. And thanks for allowing me to talk on this topic. I think, us to chat about this topic, because I think it's really interesting. Maybe 20, 30 years ago, maybe even less than that, the idea of a Westerner doing Buddhist studies was kind of odd. It became a little bit more mainstream, but there were still, that's where people do Buddhist studies. That's where they do Buddhism. But increasingly, I think people have become more and more interested in how Buddhism and Western philosophies are starting to overlap. And some very, very, very talented, very smart individuals were starting to work on Western philosophy, but they were Buddhists. They were not working on Buddhist philosophy. They were working on Western philosophy, incorporating ideas. And that's very much where I come from. I made my decision that I wasn't going to be a Buddhist studying Buddhism or bring Buddhism into Western. In fact, initially, in my master's and the beginning of my PhD, nobody knew that I was a Buddhist. And then some odd ideas started to pop up and people would say, well, why? And I'd be able to justify them. Then I'd call upon some on Buddhist thought. And what's really interesting to me is the overlap and how, you know, everyone is thinking about the same concepts, but where do people start?
Definitely something I would love to go into later on. Like, what do you think the reason is for that increase in interest in Buddhist philosophy in the Western world, and how your work is influenced by your background in Buddhist philosophy as well? But before we get into that, would you want to give a broad, really general introduction, like what is Buddhist philosophy? What are the main schools of philosophy in Buddhist philosophy for somebody who has no idea what the main themes are?
I think it's a very good idea, because people tend to run everything together. They know of a whole bunch of sayings which they say are Buddhist, and then they know about the Dalai Lama and they say, well, he's Buddhist. And then they hear about so many people around who are Buddhists. And those are three completely different types of Buddhism. Possibly the most popular in the West, and maybe by numbers all over the world, is Theravadan Buddhism, which is which is fundamental Buddhism. It's called the greater vehicle. It is in many ways a simpler approach to Buddhism. The idea of Buddhism is there's no self, and that we are part of an undivided universe in which there is mind. And mind has various aspects, and there's an aspect of mind which is behind the corporeal me. And although the body, the corporeal aspect, will die, the mind was there before, and that particular aspect of mind was there before. It was incarnate in this body, and when the body dies, there's no reason for the mind to go away, so the mind is still there. The aim of Buddhist practice is about the individual preventing him from having to be incarnated again. The idea is incarnation is suffering. It's not to say that life is all misery, but there's an awful lot of suffering in being incarnate, which there isn't in existing solely in a mental form. So in Theravadan Buddhism, that's the idea: the individual is liberated from the eternal cycle of death and rebirth. The Theravadan Buddhism was very, very strong in India, and it started to move in an easterly direction. And there it encountered Taoism or Taoism, and it was modified. I think the current phrase would be enculturated. So it became Zen Buddhism. So Zen Buddhism is Theravadan Buddhism with a bit of Taoism. The Zen Buddhists will say they're much more intellectual than Theravadan Buddhists. They have the same idea, but they do it in, they approach it in a different manner. There's a lot of meditation in Theravadan Buddhism and thought about no self. Everybody knows the phrases of the nice little catchphrases of Zen Buddhism, like the sound of one hand clapping. Well, the idea of those is that you're supposed to actually think about a phrase like that and think about the questions that arise, and you go deeper and deeper and deeper into the questions until there is no question left. And when you go to the point where there is no question, you start to get to a point where you might understand the nature of how things exist. Now, Theravadan Buddhists generally say that they don't like being looked down on by Zen Buddhists. You know, Zen say, well, we're intellectually more superior to that. And the funny phrase that the Theravadan Buddhists come up with is the only good thing about Mahayana Buddhism, which is the third school, the only good thing about Mahayana Buddhism is it's the only type of Buddhism that could look down on Zen Buddhism. It's unfair. There's no real judgment. There's no judgment at all. It's just different approaches. But Mahayana Buddhism is much more intellectual than either Zen or Theravadan. So that's the Buddhism of the Dalai Lama. And there's some very funny stories about how to think about Mahayana Buddhism. There's a wonderful interview where a very senior teacher, who's associated with my teacher, was interviewed by somebody who kept saying, "Your religion says this." And he'd go, "No, it doesn't." And she, "Oh, I'm sorry. Your religion says this." He goes, "No, it doesn't." And that went on and on and on. Eventually, the interviewer said, "Look, I'm so sorry, Rinpoche. I thought I'd rehearsed Buddhism, I'd researched Buddhism." And he said, "What do you mean Buddhism? Buddhism isn't my religion. My religion is football. Buddhism is my philosophy." So, you know, that's the idea. At that point, the ritual of Buddhism is recognized as merely a concentration device, and it becomes a philosophy.
One of the questions I was asking myself when you were talking about the Theravadan Buddhism already, like how much is it the content that makes the school what it is compared to the method of inquiry? Because it seems to me that like Western philosophy is like predominantly like in written form, and we have that like process of like really like slow development of ideas through like publication in journals and like reading, writing and analyzing. But it seems to me that like what you described of the Theravadan Buddhism is that much more it's intellectual communication through like, yeah, direct communication.
The difference is really in its foundation. The Theravadan says the individual must be liberated. That is the aim of every individual is to be liberated. The aim of the Theravadan Buddhist is for all sentient beings to be liberated. Everyone must be liberated. So that is their base, which leads to a different focus in the way things are taught and the way things are approached. They're very similar. Other view, they're not methodologically different until you get to the higher schools of Mahayana, where people recognize the distinction between practice and theory, practice and philosophy, and would drop the practice before the philosophy.
So the difference between the schools is a difference in the aim that we're trying to achieve?
Yes.
Right. Interesting. So what makes you most drawn to Mahayana Buddhism? Is that just your internal motivation? Like those are the questions that you find most interesting, or how did you?
I came for particular reasons. I was examining various things. The best way to put it was just non-physical, because I was interested. And the first, you know, the first step is having a look at New Age, and that lasts about 30 seconds because it doesn't make any sense. And then I started to look at Eastern religions, which a lot of claims by New Age that they like Eastern religions, but they're not. And I went through a whole bunch of different Eastern religions trying to find things that just made sense, that answered more questions. And I was not conscious of the significant difference between Mahayana Buddhism and Theravadan Buddhism, the theological, should we say, it's not theological, but the philosophical difference, the aims at the time. but I was attracted to and say, oh, this bunch of people, they've already got some answers, and they got some questions. They're asking the right questions. They already have the answers. They're asking really fundamental questions. And then, as it turns out, that they're the Mahayana Buddhists.
That's really fascinating. But did you start out with Western philosophy, or was that like Buddhist philosophy your first encounter with philosophy in general? Buddhist because you did a lot of other things before you came into philosophy.
Yes, I did. Standard stuff, banking, investment banking, and then philosophy. It's the usual thing. Well, Peter Goldie did it anyway. he's an English philosopher.
I've seen a few people go down that road, like either that or sort of law, policy related stuff. But yeah, banking is a usual route.
Yeah. And so my first step was towards Buddhism. And after about 8 years or so, I thought, well, what am I missing? I can't just claim that, you know, exclude all of that. And so I went to Edinburgh to do a master's and find out what the West had to offer, which is why I wasn't telling anybody I was a Buddhist, because I wanted the West, not anybody, to talk to me as a Buddhist.
Yeah. So that was I was wondering, like, what was your reason for not telling anyone that you were originally trained in the Buddhist, or like that you follow a Buddhist philosophy?
Well, what I don't want is to put forward an idea in a forum of any sort, and people just say, oh, well, that's a Buddhist idea, never mind that. Because they put it in a box and they say, I don't have to address that because it's Buddhist. So when I come out with an idea, people will look at it and say, well, that's an odd idea. I wonder where he got that from, but we have to look at the idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. That, yeah, even if it's not a school that you're following, you have a certain kind of like look onto things. Like you'll come up with similar types of questions or answers. And then at one point that might just be put in like a box of like that kind of answer, rather than taken, like the idea would not be taken anymore as like merits by its own means. Is that even an expression in English? How do you say that?
Taken on its own merits, I think. Taken on its own merits. That's absolutely right. I mean, we all tend to do that, you know, say, oh, we know what Graham thinks, we know what Johanna thinks, so that's just what they think. It's difficult.
Yeah. So and then how does your work now integrate? How's the Western philosophy, how has it influenced the kinds of questions that you're asking now?
Well, I'm much freer now, because obviously doing the PhD, I'm free to ask questions. I've given it a lot of thought, and I think the fundamental difference is one of approach. There are a lot of assumptions made in Western philosophy that are just not made in Mahayana Buddhism. The Mahayana Buddhists will say, well, why is that the case? Rather than, you know, we assume, I think that therefore I am. You say, well, why is that the case? What would that be? And there are very, very fundamental questions that are asked in Mahayana Buddhism as a basis. And what I find particularly fascinating, I'm getting to the core of your question, what I find really fascinating is some of the work I'm doing now, or some of the reading I'm doing now, not directly on my thesis, that people are asking questions about properties of matter and properties of objects and properties of things like just motion. And these are very startling questions to be asking in a Western environment. There's a group in Brussels that's just really, they're a bunch of theoretical physicists, and they're asking some pretty fundamental questions. And a colleague of mine, a friend of mine, sent me a paper and said, I think you'll like this. And they're asking all these really, really weird questions. So I'm going, yeah, because those questions were asked by a master by the name of Nagarjuna in, I think, it's the first century AD.
So what you take for granted in a way, like the kinds of questions that you would ask those kinds of questions as like Western philosophers, which is like...
Just don't. Yes. Yeah. So why would you say that? You know, that's in motion. Well, why would you say it's in motion? Show me the property of motion. Well, there isn't any motion. It has no property of motion at position A, T1. Position B, T2, it has no property of motion. but it moved from one to the other. So we'll just would abstract the idea of motion, which is a very Buddhist idea. We've abstracted everything. And I think we're getting, there's a lot of work being done, which is getting closer and closer to Mahayana Buddhist ideas. But the point of asking more fundamental questions, I think is a difference in approach, and it's very, very useful for me.
So
more specifically on my thesis, which is based largely on emotions and perception. Very important. I chose it because it's very important, both very important topics in Mahayana Buddhism. And the more modern approach to particularly psychotherapy for emotions and the nature of emotions is very, very similar to the treatment that both Mahayana and Theravadan Buddhists would give to emotions. And similarly to perception, what are we actually looking at? I'm not a proponent of relativism in perception, but there's no absolute out there. You know, what I see is not exact. I don't see the world in exactly the same way, in the same shapes and everything as a bee does. And these are questions which, you know, were statements that the Buddhists were making, Nagarjuna was making in the first century.
What is the school in philosophy that you think, particularly for the topic of affect and emotions, is there any Western philosophical school where you think this has most overlap with the general assumptions that like Buddhist philosophers also go into the world with, or are there maybe to put it in a different way, the general kinds of questions that you ask are things you wouldn't take for granted?
Well, the nearest formal theory, oddly enough, comes from a neuroscientist who—it's Barrett, Lisa Feldman Barrett. Her theory on emotions, her constructivism, is very scientific, very step by step, with a few little bits of polish. It looks very, very Mahayana. We're creating everything. It's not just Barrett. There are other constructionists as well. I just think Barrett has the most complete idea, with a few modifications. So. The idea that we create our own worlds in which we live is a very Buddhist idea. And in fact, in her latest book, Feldman Barrett actually says in one of the last chapters, so if you want to start sorting yourself out, if you want to take care of your own unhappiness and stress and misfortune, start meditating. And I burst out laughing when I did that, because I'm just going to think, yeah. And then she laughed. She said, well, I said, okay, good. That's a pretty good overlap.
Do you think that is one of the symptoms of this general movement, which you've described, of more openness towards Buddhist philosophies, like other philosophies outside of the Western tradition, which has been starting to happen over the past 20, 30 years?
I think it takes a deliberate effort to find the bridging. Barrett had no idea. She'd been doing this theory, working on this theory for more than 20 years. And last year or year before, she suddenly encountered Buddhism in some way or another and thought, oh my God, that's exactly what we need to be doing. So I think it takes a certain amount of effort, because people are, interestingly, in the West, they're pursuing a line and ending up, without knowing it, in a quasi-Buddhist position. Then there are people who are doing some cross-cultural stuff. I mean, Guneri is a very highly intellectual Theravadan Buddhist. He wrote an enormous book called Attention, Not Self. And the very fundamental idea of Buddhism is there's no self, and psychologists and Western philosophers are trying to find out what it is. I think we've settled on the idea there's no self, there's just a sense of self, which is fine. But Guneri came up with this idea that that sense of self is based in attention. And he wrote an enormous, enormous book. I did a review of the book, and he put forward this idea that it's a Theravadan idea, but he runs it parallel with modern Western ideas as well. I don't care so much for his conclusion, but I do care for the way that he it just shows so many parallels in research and conclusions.
One thing that kind of stuck with me at the beginning of our conversation, we talked about like the different motivations of the different schools within Buddhist philosophy, right? So you said like Theravadan Buddhism, for example, if I remember correctly, had the goal of like freeing the individual. And for Mahayana Buddhism, you also have that idea of like liberating sentient beings. I was wondering, like, what is the initial goal you think of Western philosophy? And does an integration of the two philosophies change the goal? Yeah, I'm a bunch of questions.
No, I understand entirely. I think that the motivations are identical. The fundamental motivation is understanding. And it, you know, all the, you know, the notions of liberation of self and liberation of all sentient beings, the notion of liberation, the notion of reincarnation, these are not things that were sought. These are things that were concluded. There are the notion of the existence of mind and how mind came into being. And there's some extremely coldly rational arguments that mind must have existed, for instance, before the birth of the infant. The infant's mind or aspect of mind must have existed that incarnated as the infant, because the infant doesn't have the tools with which to create incorporeal mind. You know, you can't plant an apple tree and a building grow. So there's nothing in the mind that looks anything like what was in the infant. So the mind must have been there before the infant and becomes part of the infant. A consequence of that, I mean, that is trying to understand the nature of existence and the nature of mind. So, well, how do we get this? You know, part of our existence is the mind. Where does the mind come from? Well, we know where the body comes from. We know where life comes from. It's passed on. But mind, can mind be passed on? Well, that seems a bit odd because, you know, that doesn't seem to work. Okay, we seem to, mind must have been there. Now, what are the consequences of that? And only when you start thinking of the consequences of that, do you start getting to things that people associate with Buddhism, which is things like reincarnation and the cycle of life and of death and rebirth. But those were not the point. The point was understanding and asking very, very fundamental questions like, what is the mind? What is motion? And what is an object? And I think we're asking the same questions. To a large extent, Western philosophy is tied to Western science. And there are a lot of reasons why science will start from the position that everything is physical. And they do that because they can investigate it. And that's fine, because you do wonderful things by assuming that, and you'd work wonders in the physical world. But then you have to ask, how good is that assumption? So we have to prove that assumption first. And that's not something that is not in the purview of the scientist. It's in the purview of the philosopher. So we have to see, how good is that assumption? And why should we make that assumption? Should we not question it first? And then we have other reasons to, you know, examine scientific method. Scientific method is a matter of observation. So if I'm using a particular instrument, I must understand that instrument before I can understand the results that it's giving me. So scientific process involves the ultimate instrument is the observer, the human being. So, well, let's find out what that's all about before we can still use science, but it's not answering all the fundamental questions. It's answering a lot of questions about physical. That's really great, but it's not answering the question about the ultimate observer. Now, what is that observer? So we have to start asking those questions on a different trajectory. Science has taken us all the way back, I think, to fundamental questions about what objects are, and, you know, and what object is, what an individual is, what the observer is. And this is the area of quantum mechanics and quantum physics, and some great experimental and theoretical work that's being done there. But I think it's a different trajectory, same motivations. What is going on here? What is all of this?
What is the world we live in? We're almost at the end of our time now. But before we end this podcast, I would like to ask you, if somebody is like interested in getting a hold of what Buddhist philosophy is, or what kind of philosophy is being done, where would you suggest that person to start?
There's a series of books, and I hope you can supplement this podcast with some written stuff, because I don't remember.
I'll put it in the description.
His name is Geshe Sesi Tsering. We will have to write that down.
I'm going to ask you to, yes.
He was actually my first Mahayana teacher in London, and a wonderful guy. And he spent a lot of time in France, and then moved over to London, spent 20 years there. But he has written an unbelievably accessible series of books on Mahayana Buddhism. I think it's a product of where he was in London. He's down in Elephant and Castle, and people were coming because they were, you know, just a bit lost in this society, what's going on. And they didn't come to him because they wanted Buddhism. They thought, oh, maybe they've got something there. And he wanted to teach the fundamentals. Really easy, easy reading. I was very disappointed, actually, because I'd been studying by myself, just trying to find papers and books and reading all sorts of things all over the place for about 3 or 4 years before I came across Geshe. And then I came across his books. I thought, well, that'd be nice if I knew known about
this. So much easier.
Yes.
Yeah. But
these books are very good. They're in a series of, you know, more and more complicated expositions of Buddhist theory. So very nicely written.
I'll put a link. If I can find the link, then I'll put the link in the description. If not, then I'll just put the name out there.
They're all available on, I think they're all available even on Kindle.
Oh, nice. Do you think it's the sort of read that you could also do like in an evening with a glass of wine?
Yes.
That's perfect.
Buddhism is not, there is an awful lot of really, really complicated, deep stuff in it if you want to go that far.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to go that far. You want to know, give me some basics. I want to know what these guys are talking about.
Yeah.
Geshe Tsering Tsering is the guy to go to, because he will just say, you know, these are the fundamentals.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for taking your time again to record this podcast. That was really interesting. And I wonder if we could do another session another day where we talk more about, you know, your work more specifically, because I think that's also something really interesting to talk about if you're up for it, but you don't have to commit.
No, I'm up for it. I'm more than happy to talk about my topic. I don't know how interesting it is, but we can record it. And if it's not interesting, don't put in a podcast. I don't mind doing that.
Yeah, perfect.